Hi, this is Xavier Schley from the Build Alaska podcast series. We've discovered some previously recorded legacy videos that were produced for the Construction Industry Progress Fund to help capture the contribution of a generation of Alaskans to the construction industry. We've digitized these videos to help preserve their content and make them available to the public.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about when you first came to Alaska and how you got here and why you got here and what it was like that back then.
Well, I had been working for the Iowa Highway Department in Ames, and I interviewed with Lockheed. They came through, had a big recruiting session there in Des Moines, and I filled out an application with them, and they accepted me and wanted me to go to work for them. And then I went out to the university there at Ames, see old Prof. Stewart, who was head of the department, and told him I was leaving. He said, I got lots of jobs. Requests around here, he started looking at them, and most of them are county engineer jobs, or assistant county engineer jobs, so I wasn't much interested in that. Then he had one from outfit called Green Construction, and one of the guys that had graduated about 4 or 5 years ahead of me had called them and said they needed 2 recruits to go to Alaska. Well, that sounded kind of interesting, so when I got home, I called, and he says, come on down and talk to us. We've hired one, and we decided we'd get along with just one instead of 2, but come down and talk to us anyhow. So I did, and ended up going with them instead of Lockheed. So I went to work for about a week there in a home office there in Des Moines, and they sent me right to Alaska, and I came up here then to go to work right here in Anchorage.
What year was that?
That was about the first or second week of 1952. Mm-hmm. And the job was putting base course and pavement down on a highway from Fourth and Gamble to Girdwood, plus Fireweed Lane from Gamble over to Spinard Road.
That was all one project?
All one contract, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How did, what kind of tools were you using back then? I mean, what kind of equipment?
Well, the equipment was all here. They had just finished building the International Airport job. They'd been working on it for 3 years and just finished it the fall before. And all that stuff was parked out on Sand Lake Road and a homestead out there, which was also a borrow pit for us in the construction of the airport. Mm-hmm. And it was mostly Barbara Green and Ford. Of course, Mr. Green had a half interest in a Ford agency in a small town in the southern part of Iowa. I can't remember the name of the town now.
Okay. Was the airport all done by then, by the time you came?
That contract was. There was still no terminal building, and they let the terminal building that spring. And Carson Construction from Montana got that. There was a small one there that Art Woodley owned, Pacific Northern Airlines, built a little stick building out there, and he started flying into the airport earlier than anybody else.
Yeah.
When I flew in, we landed at Elmendorf. I came up with Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about the road to Girdwood and what was it before you started?
Well, they just completed the grading on it the year before. They'd been working on it for about 3 years. See, that road, for the most part, well, apart from Potter to, oh, almost a Bird, Bird Point, past Bird Creek. What they did was move the railroad out and then build the road on the old railroad grade.
Okay.
So it was quite a complex job, and it was a joint venture of MK and PK that did the grading work on that part of it.
And so Green just had the surface in it.
Crushing and paving.
Where'd you go from there?
We finished that job about, oh, two-thirds of the way through August, and right after Labor Day, they sent me over to Corova. And we got the contract. They had got a contract over there to build the first segment of the new Copper River Highway that was going to connect Corova with the world. It was about an 8-10 mile job from the Corova Airport out to the Copper River.
Okay. Then beyond that, you spent quite a bit of time down in Juneau. Later? Or?
Yeah, that was later. That I didn't go down there until 60. Well, I went the last few weeks down to Sitka, where we had a street job to replace a college kid that had to go back to college in September to finish out the fall. Or he was the job office man and engineer combination. So I went down there because I'd finished my assignment and filled in. Then I got married, and we came back the following spring and went back to Sitka. And then we got a bigger job at Petersburg about a few weeks later, and we went over there. And then there was a strike. Meanwhile, we'd gotten a airport job during this strike and under a different name, Northern States Contracting. And so I went up there because I'd been around paving work for about that time almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I was the engineer on that runway job there in Juneau, paving the extension to the runway. And I stayed in Juneau. We got more work there. I stayed there for about 5 years.
Okay. Let's see. Let's jump ahead a little bit. Talk about the pre-pipeline era and when the discovery took off, and you're involved with the pipeline a little bit.
Discovery took off.
Well, when they discovered oil in
Prudhoe Bay, yeah.
Decided they were going to build a pipeline.
Well,
involved there.
Yeah, that was about 5 years later, actually. After when I left Juneau in January of 66, I guess it was. Or 65. The reason I left, I was promoted. I replaced Herman as the Alaska manager, and they sent me to Seattle because that was the most convenient place to be to get to all our work. We had work at Nome, and we had work at St. Mary's, I believe, at that time, and Kodiak, and a lot of work in Ketchikan at the time. Still working in Juneau. and we had a job at Yakutat. And the way airlines were in those days, you could get from Seattle to any one of those places by mid-morning, Alaska time. But if you were in Fairbanks, where most of our center of activity was, our equipment yard and all was in Fairbanks, to get from Fairbanks to Ketchikan was about a two-day trip by air in those days. In fact, the quickest way would be to fly to Seattle and come back. But so I worked out of the Seattle area for 5 years. And then when things started opening up on the slope, the thing that really got to us was Chevron Oil let a contract to Lloyd Burgess, who was a building contractor, to build a Dead Horse Airport. And here we had never, Ralph and Rick Green, my boss, had never, there was only two oil companies selling oil fuel in Alaska at that time, Standard Oil of California and Union Oil. And he got crosswise with Union Oil back in during the war days over something rather, that was for my time. And he was always been strictly a Chevron customer ever since then. And here we weren't even notified about the job, didn't even know about it until after it was awarded. It was read it in the newspaper. And it was pretty obvious at that point that things were going on up there that we didn't know anything about because we had no reputation here in Anchorage. And all the oil companies were headquartered here. They weren't in Fairbanks and they weren't in Seattle. They were in Anchorage. And everything was happening here. So the decision was made to shift me and what little group we had in that Seattle office up to Anchorage. And that was, we moved up here about April of 1970. And discovery of oil was 68, as I recall.
I think so.
Yeah. So things are going on pretty hot and heavy there during 1970, and they actually took bids to build a road that's fall of 1970. And I spent most of my time in Houston, summer and fall of 70. And then, of course, there was an injunction against the goddarn pipeline job in the first place because they didn't get a environmental impact statement. Mm-hmm. If they started the whole thing about 6 months sooner, they would have beat the law that went into effect that made that possible. But they didn't. So they actually didn't start working on that road job until 1974.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved with any of the route selection on the
no.
pipeline?
Or? Well, yeah. Yeah, we were. Chal Beard and I, wasn't Chal, it was Herman. Herman Reichman and myself, Alyeska, TAPS guy, as they called it in those days, pipeline guy, got hold of us. Well, actually, it was Jim Rooney, who was the R of R&M mm-hmm. engineers later on, but he was working for TAPS at the time. He got a hold of us and chartered a plane and flew us over Attican Pass and then Anatuvik Pass. And they were trying to make up a mind which way to route the pipeline, and we were to look at it flying about 100 feet in the air over both mm-hmm. passes to see which was be best from a constructability standpoint. And there was no question in our minds which was best. It was Attican would be better. Mm-hmm. Attica was higher altitude than Anatovic, but that didn't faze them so much. It was also shorter, so I guess the hydraulics of the pumping were about the same.
Mm-hmm. Then later on, we got into the road building, access road building. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we mobilized in 1970. We were awarded three sections out of the seven sections of the road, sections 2, 3, and 4. And that ran from, just south of Prospect up to point, north of, just no, up to the summit, I guess it was a break. Yeah, the summit was the end of that hard work at that point. And we had three camps. We moved in that spring for a breakup. Everything was hauled up over the ice, over the river, over the Yukon on ice, and all any other river, and cross country with tractors, snow, ice roads, and snow roads. And we built three camps, Prospect, Coldfoot, and Dietrich. Those were our camps. And the jobs were envisioned to be three separate jobs, working from those camps out in both directions. So there was a contractor to the south of us, and there was one, two, three contractors north of us. Mm-hmm. Well, then we got the camp set up, and we got airstrips built, roughed in and built, because those camps had to be supported completely by air, as did all the others along the line. The other contractors were doing the same thing as we were doing at the time. And then we, about the time we were going to start some actual building of the road, this injunction was slapped on the job, and that's when everything came to complete halt. Mm-hmm. For almost four years.
Yeah.
And we had about three or four people in each camp just kind of being watchmen. Somebody wouldn't come in and vandalize or steal something. And that whole thing.
Well, when it kicked off again after the injunction was lifted, about how many people that were working there and all those?
Well, when they lifted the injunction, things had changed a little bit. All us contractors went in with our own equipment and everything was cost plus. It was a cost plus a percentage fee for all the four contractors that were working. And the others right away started. There was a standby rate for the equipment, and the standby rate was pretty cheap. And an operating rate when you were working. And they weren't getting any money. Nobody was. But Mullins was the first one to cry, and so the Alyeskas, by that time, somewhere along in that time is when they became Alaska, Alyeska Pipeline instead of TAPS. Mm-hmm. They cut a deal with Mullins and bought all our equipment and our camp and everything they had up there and just bought out their contract, really. Mm-hmm. And then that happened to the other. Burgess had two sections. They had the first section and the seventh section on each end. Burgess, Houston. And then there was another contractor, can't remember his name now. It was just north of Galbraith. But Mullins was at Galbraith, and there was another one just north of him. And anyhow, the Alyeska bought them all out. So when they came up with the we didn't do that. We talked to Home Office about it, and Ralph Green, our boss, our owner, company, said, "No, we'll just hang on to our equipment." In fact, we had more work because as Alyeska bought these other camps out, we had more guys working for us up there, standby in their camps, guarding their equipment, which was insignificant, really. But they took bids again when they got the clearance to go ahead. Now, this time was different. The cost was reimbursable, but you bid a fixed fee. But we didn't do that because we still had our existing contract on three sections. But we bid all seven sections, and they ended up awarding two more to us. We had a total of five sections. And they added those, the one to the south of us and a section to the north of us. And they changed the conditions of those to our original contract. So we had we still had a pure cost plus contract for five of the seven sections. The other two sections went to Guy Rivers and Burgess Houston on the north end. And they still had a reimbursable job, but with a fixed fee. And then everything was going fixed fee. Everything was reimbursable on all the contracts, pipeline and everything. But things didn't always go as things were planned, and we had to jump in and do a lot of other things, like run a ferry system across the Yukon River for two summers with those flexi float barges, with they converted them into hovercrafts with those fans they mounted on them, put a whole bunch of them together for a great big barge. They had two of them, and they didn't run with by propeller or air fans or anything. They just towed them across the river. They run on cables. Okay. One would go across and he'd pull the other one back. Because they were all hooked together with the pulleys on each shore. Greg Jenkins was the admiral of that fleet for... Well, you were up here then.
Yeah.
So we did that under that same... They could get us to go in and do that without any negotiations because we had a contract that would cover anything come along, like building the camp at Tansina and things like that. And then a big operation at the Fairbanks Airport. Hell, that went on for 2 years, handling incoming freight and loading them on airplanes. Mm-hmm. Well, 1 year, actually, because the road was open after the end of 1 year. But, the road was open except for the bridge wasn't completed over the river yet. But because we kept because Mr. Green kept that contract, we ended up with one hell of a lot of work there. We did our contract, our estimate for the work we were going to do was about $40 million, as I recall, and we were paid $82 or $83 million for that work that summer of '74, and. But the work that money that was actually paid to us for the work we did on the road turned out to be about $44 million. We were about maybe 10% over our original estimate. All the rest of the money was from all these other things that were going on at the side that weren't even part of the contract to start with. And Benny Dennis run that operation at the airport there. He had about, oh, I guess 150 people are working 7/12s, two shifts. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Fairbanks Wolf Panthers baseball team used to lean on Mort up there to give some work to the ball players. And he'd have them working around their dealer at Weeks Field painting fences or some damn thing. And so he took two of them to work, put two of them to work over there at the airport on that 7/12 thing, and they were making so much money they quit the ball team.
Let's step back. What changes took place with statehood?
Statehood?
Between the Alaska Road Commission changing over to the Department of Highways.
Yeah, that was... I was in Juneau when that happened. Well, I wasn't in Juneau. That election was in 58, wasn't it? And we became a state in 59. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was earlier than that. They're celebrating the 50th year this year, so it had to be 59. Yeah, and they had their first election, I guess. Well, I don't know how that worked out, but when I went into Juneau in 61, in the summertime, I didn't go out that winter. I spent my first winter in Alaska that winter because we were working right up till New Year's Day, hauling gravel. And that would have been 62, the next year. And they had an election in the fall of 62. So the first election must have been 60. Because that was the second legislature, and the first legislature met. They had in the House 40 members, 36 of them were Democrats and 4 Republicans. Then 2 years later, the election turned in 20 Democrats and 20 Republicans, and they had a tie. And Jerry Wade's dad was kind of the lieutenant governor at the time, and he'd sat in there in the chair trying to organize till they organized the Speaker of the House. And every vote, everybody that came up for to be elected or to be approved for it, there'd be 24 and 20 against. No matter what party nominated who, and that went on for about almost a month, and I didn't have anything to do that winter, and so I sat there in the gallery watching all this stuff. It was kind of interesting, but they finally got going, and I don't know. There was a lot of opposition throughout the state organizing into a state because everything was financed by the feds under territorial status. And nobody could figure out how the hell the state was going to raise enough money to run the operation themselves. But one thing that really, there was a statewide vote whether to try for statehood or not. It passed, and that vote brought forth that constitutional convention they had up at the university in Fairbanks, and we sent two people as senators back to Washington, and another representative along with Bob Bartlett, who was been our territorial representation all along in the House. And these guys were just figureheads. They didn't have anything to do. That was just guys that could lobby, sort of. Mm-hmm. And but that election never would have passed in favor of that if it hadn't been for the senator from Nevada, McCarran. What's the name of the airport?
McCarran.
Yeah. He pushed a bill through Congress that had his name on it. And one of the things that it did that required everybody flying from Alaska back to Seattle had to go through immigration and customs. I don't guess we went through customs, we had to go through immigration. And that just burned the shit out of Alaskans. And then for that hadn't been going on. That had been going on about 2 years before this election took place. And if that hadn't been the case, that never would have passed, because there was a lot of opposition to statehood. Mm-hmm. But luckily, about that's the time when they start hitting oil down around Swanson River. And I remember they had a big lease sale over across the bay. Tannic, is that the name of village across the way there?
Tyonic,
yeah. And they were expecting to get maybe $500,000 in, or a couple of $1 million in lease money. Heck, they got 35 or 6 million. And that was the size of the whole state budget in those days. And that right there bailed them out right there that 1 year, you know. And then when the Poodle Bay sale, that brought in $900 million. That was in, that'd be 69, I guess that took place. Where were we?
Well, we were kind of talking about the change of statehood.
Well,
the road commission to the highway department.
Yeah, the roads, I don't know, there wasn't much. They hired new people for the... No, they didn't either. They transferred... the highway department, when they first organized, was part of the public works department. And that lasted for about a year and a half. And moved the highway department over as a separate department of the and the state government had its own commissioner. Mm-hmm. And they brought in a whole bunch of young engineers, except in Fairbanks they had Woody Johansson up there. He'd been with the Alaska Road Commission for in charge up there before. He was still there. They had a Valdez district in the old days too, and he was down there for a while. That's where I first got to know him. But I don't know, there was pretty much a changeover. Some of those old Alaska Road Commission guys went to the BPR, as it was in those days, Public Roads Administration. And really, it was pretty smooth, I guess. They didn't have any money for a while, you know, until... But it started coming in from the feds. They're pretty well at a faster rate than what they were. They were dependent every year before that on congressional appropriations every year, and you never knew what they were going to be. Mm-hmm. To the Interior Department. The Road Commission was under the Interior Department.
Do you have any thoughts or remembrances about the Parks Highway? That was the last real road we built. far as the state, you know, on a point-to-point highway.
Well, we got one of the early jobs right after statehood was from Nenana down to Clear. I guess it was the early job we got, and we got a couple after that on the Nenana Road, but that road was already in existence. That was just rebuilding it and realigning it, those two jobs. But
do I remember a story about a superintendent charging a toll to another contractor up in that area?
Yeah, that wasn't a superintendent. That was John Coghill. He had the grocery store in Nenana. And he put a cable across the road with a lock on it and charged people. That was after the road was open to Clear. It was passable to Clear. We weren't done working, but his story was he was collecting money to give to the state to replace the stakes that the traveling public would be knocking down and things like that. We didn't have, that wasn't our doing.
Mm. I'd heard another story one time that there was a contractor that was charging another one.
Oh, that was what Jack told you. They were working at that time when we were working on a road to Clear on a job coming up from just north of Healy to where the bridge goes over the Nenana River.
Rex,
yeah. And they had a hell of a time with that job. Herb Miller was down in Juneau about every 10 days or so. I was working on the Juneau Airport at the time, and we'd have four jets come in every day about the same time, about midday. And we had a little Wanigan office right there by the airport across the road from the terminal building. When it come plane time, I'd lock up the office and go over there and see what was coming and going. Mm-hmm. Everybody would be there at one time. And two airlines coming in, let's see, Alaska. Well, Alaska wasn't even going to the southeast at that time yet. But there was a Pan Am had a flight coming south that would be stop. I guess it would be three jets. And Western Airlines, or Pacific Northern, and or Western, they merged at some point in time in Longaner. Had one coming north and one coming south at the same time that landed. So there'd be three jets on the plane, same on the field, same time. And Irv would be out there coming down from Anchorage. Some of the problems they were having. Mm-hmm. His complaint about the job was the special provisions warned the contractor in the first couple of pages that they should be warned that there would be occasional permafrost on this section of road. He says, shit, occasional permafrost? It's all permafrost. He would come in, and Irv being Jack's dad, mm-hmm. and I'd give him a ride down to the downtown to the hotel, and he'd generally have me come in, and he'd buy me lunch. I got to know him pretty well. He was quite a guy, and he was telling me about that time, the winter before, he went down to Arizona with Truman Sage, who was in charge of the president of NCCAT. They went down to the proving grounds, Caterpillar proving grounds in Arizona, and they were watching these new scrapers work. They'd had working down there, and they're 657s, twin engine, And they were watching it. And he just picked up two jobs. He picked up that one from Rex to Healy, and another one over on the Glen Highway from, oh, about 20 miles this side of Glen Allen over towards...
Oh, Mendelton area?
Yeah, Mendelton, yeah. And generally, he never went over the Alaska Range, very seldom to get work or... But he was up to his eyebrows in dirt work, those two jobs, and they... So he was down there looking at these things, and Truman sat there watching him move the dirt, and they were good machines compared with the old... the predecessor machines were the old cable scrapers, you know, all hydraulic. And Truman is pushing him a little bit. He says, well, what do you think, Irv? He says, well, they're pretty good machines, all right. They'll do the job, all right. Well, he says, well, how many you want? Well, he says, well, what do they cost? Well, he says, Cat had their list price, and he says, well, I'll give you, he says, what, he didn't say what they cost, he knew what they listed for. He says, what kind of discount do you give me? Well, he asked him. He said, well, I'll give you 1% for everyone you buy. If you buy a fleet of five, I'll give you a 5% discount. If you buy a fleet of six, I'll give you a 6% discount. Oh, that sounds workable. By golly, I'll take 101. Well, you had to know Truman Sage. He was kind of a egotistical old asshole. And that really tickled Irv.
That story is still told at NC.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it happened. But I don't know, there was no big interruption because the highway program wasn't that big a program up here in under territorial days. Mm-hmm. And they kind of got squared away pretty fast. Put together a real good bridge department. They got a guy up from Texas be in charge of that, and there are some real good people in that, including the guy who was just at the meeting here today, Dennis Nottingham. And the guy, his former partner, was one of them from, what was his name?
Paradovich?
Yeah, Paradovich from Kluwak.
Talk a little bit about how things were communication and logistics a little bit from early on to.
Well, that was a problem when I came up here to make a long distance call. We had a camp at Rainbow for this paving job from Anchorage to Girdwood. And Rainbow is a siding, first siding south of Potter siding. And we took over the grading contractor's camp. They'd build it up there on the hillside, way up on, off the road, and quite a drive to get up to it. But we bought that camp for our use after they'd finished our job, and we were a little bitter on the job for the next year. So, but I couldn't make a... We were hooked up with the railroad telephone system, hand crank, so many rings, three longs and a short, and that kind of thing. And every section house from Anchorage to Seward was on the same party line. Well, you had a hell of a time finding a time when the telephone wasn't being used by somebody, and he couldn't make a toll call beyond the railroad's line, and I had the call. We had to call outside for parts, or Seattle for parts, or the home office in Iowa. Had to drive clear down town to what was the federal building across the street from the Mermac Bar. Well, what is it now? F Street Station, yeah. And the Alaska Road, Alaska's communication system, run by the Army Signal Corps, had all the telephones up here in those days, long-distance telephones. They had an office in there, but you had to stand in line and wait to get to place a call. So it was inconvenient.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get to, if you're paving and you had to talk to your hot plant, how did...
Well, on this job, we couldn't. We didn't have radios at work. And I don't think they'd work even today with the mountains that are in the way. But 59 was my first job as a project manager. And that job ran from, right about the 40-mile roadhouse to the border, Canadian border. 70 miles long, and we had radios, but they were citizen band radios or some damn thing. We couldn't talk to hardly anybody who was more than 5 miles away or so. So you had to do a lot of driving.
Anything else you remember? I mean, about your time here. You mentioned that they used to go outside in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much normal.
Yeah. Every winter, as soon as job shut down, it was generally about the 1st of October. We'd never just leave. We'll go back to work in the home office. Well, generally went back there, not always. I spent a couple of winters working in our California office in San Mateo. And actually in 57 and 58, I wasn't even up here. I was in Canada, in Alberta. We had a operation up there for several years.
When you first came up, did you fly or did you? Yeah, you did say you flew.
Yeah, we flew up. Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm about dry.
Okay. Anything else, Pete, you can think of? Any other stories you'd like to tell?
I don't think a lot of them that I really can't tell. Especially that first year I went to Cordova, they still had wide open line over there.
Those are the ones we want to record. The ones you can't tell.
When you were in Cordova, was Al Swalling there?
No.
He'd already looked.
Yeah, he was over there in Anchorage by then. He was there in the mid early 30s. And he left there early in the war, went to, from there to Whittier, worked on the tunnel, and then when that was over, he came to Anchorage. He never did go back to Cordova. Minnie was from Cordova. He met her over there.
Any AGC questions? Would you like to tell about Do you know your early days with AGC or your days with AGC?
Oh, I don't know. The most memorable part was going to the national conventions in those days. And then there was always had the hottest spot in the hotel for a hospitality room. Now we don't even have a hospitality room anymore.
Well, you need to tell that story. We should record it.
Hmm?
How we kind of take over by refrigerator.
Ed Smith, who was Stan's dad, had your job, what job you had there. And he'd get in the city where the convention was being held about a day or two early, and he'd round up a used refrigerator and have it delivered to this room he had reserved for the hospitality room. And then he had, as soon as the rest of us started showing up, he'd have us all go down and buy a shopping bag full of booze, some liquor store he'd have scouted out by then, and we'd sneak him in the hotel to get away from the corkage. He was supposed to pay the hotel, you know, and those kind of things. And that thing would open up as soon as somebody showed up in the morning or whenever, and went until 2 or 3 in the morning before they'd shut her down. Those days we had guys like George Atkinson and Dave Stock. They were there all the time. And we always took along, Ed used to always bring along a prize winner from the fair up in Palmer. He lived in Palmer. And he put it on a table there, about that big around the Alaska Brussels sprout, they call them. Generally be the blue ribbon winner at the fair. That was in the fall, the mid-year, not in January or in March. But the year that after I got married to Sonia, the convention was in San Antonio. We took it down there, and it was pretty warm down there. But it was, the convention that year, it was a little bit later than normal, but instead of right around the last week in September, first week in October, it was about maybe the third week in October. And that thing started getting kind of ripe. And we had a room right above the hospitality room, our room. Man, you could smell that thing. But everybody came to the hospitality room. Now, we got to know all the national staff on a personal level pretty well, you know. As soon as they got done with their work, doing all their typing and things they had to do, and mimeographing and all that stuff for what happened during the day, their old staff would come up to our room. That'd be about 11, 12 at night maybe, and start drinking in earnest. And
definitely legends. We still hear about that.
Yes, I bet you do. Well, you can't hear it too much because most of those people ain't around anymore.
Well, they pass it down.
Yeah.
And you have guys like Bristol and Washington.
Well, he was around in those days, yeah.
He remembers that.
Yeah. He was around when the years I worked out of Seattle. And there was two chapters down there then, Mountain Pacific chapter for the heavy contractors, and then the Seattle chapter for the building contractors. And then they merged and built that building on Lake Union.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.